be here to have a chance to talk to you. Sorry I wasn't here yesterday, but I was speaking at Cornell, so I only flew in last night. Actually, early in the morning. So, what I'd like to talk to you about the newest part is joint work with my student Sergey Narin. And actually, some of the results are just Sergey's. This will be about matchings. So, you surely all know what I mean by a graph. I mean a finite, and for the purpose of this talk, it may as well be simple. A matching is a set of edges so that every vertex is incident with at most one of them. A perfect matching is a set of edges so that every vertex is incident with exactly one of those edges. The subject of matchings and perfect matchings is of fundamental importance in combinatorial optimization in graph theory, and is also of interest in mathematical physics. And it's actually the connection with mathematical physics which motivate the notion I'll be talking about. So what physicists are interested in are perfect matchings in graphs with some regular structure, such as planar lattices. And the particular model of interest here is what they call the dimer model. So you should think about the graph as a model of a physical material where the vertices represent atoms. And in this model, the atoms have a tendency to form two atom molecules. So physicists call the atoms monomers, and the two atom molecules are called dimers. And in this model, the assumption is that these dimers cover the entire vertex. So they call it a dimer covering. So what I mean is a perfect matching. So an example of a dimer cover could look like this. And what they want to know is how many perfect matchings there are. It often turns out that the number of, well, if the graph is some regular structure, it often turns out that the number of matchings is proportional to some constant eta to the number of vertices. And that constant eta is of interest in mathematical physics. They call it the entropy of the system. And in order to calculate the entropy of the planar grid, Castellane in the 60s invented a method which became known as Pfaffian orientations, and that's what I want to talk about because I want to study it from a graph theory point of view. So what is a Pfaffian orientation? So first I need to tell you what a Pfaffian of a matrix is. So suppose we have a square 2n by 2n skew symmetric matrix. So skew symmetric means Aij is minus Aji. And for such a matrix, we can define the following quantity, which is called the Pfaffian of the matrix, as follows. So it's going to be a sum of the following: sine of a permutation where you permute 1 to 2n into i1, j1, i2, j2, da da da, in, jn, times a i1, j1, a i2, j2, a in, jn. And the summation is over all unordered sets of unordered pairs of numbers between 1 and 2n, and the assumption, which I'm not going to write down, there's an implicit assumption that the the numbers I1, J1, etc., exhaust the entire set from 1 to 2n. So that's an old concept. One thing you need to notice is that this is actually well defined, because, you know, I need to convince you that if I swap, say, I1 and J1, then the quantity doesn't change. But it doesn't, because if I swap I1 and J1, I will change the sign of the permutation, but I will also change the sign of the number right here, because the matrix is skew symmetric. This is what we're using, that the matrix is skew symmetric. Likewise, if I swap two of these pairs, then again the quantity won't change, because I will be making two transpositions to my permutation, and I won't be changing the product over there. There is a lemma from linear algebra which says that the square of the Pfaffian is equal to the determinant of the matrix, which in turn implies that the Pfaffian can be calculated efficiently. So, of course, you don't calculate the Pfaffian by evaluating the sum, but you can calculate the determinant efficiently, and from there you can read off, or at least the absolute value of the Pfaffian. Now, how is this related to graphs? Suppose now that A is a skew adjacency matrix of a graph. So I'll start with a graph, G, and I'll take an orientation of G, and then my matrix will be defined as follows. Aij is 1 if ij is an edge, minus 1 if ji. Sorry, this is supposed to be D, is an edge in the orientation, and 0 otherwise, if I and J are not adjacent. That's a skew symmetric matrix, and it's called a skew adjacency matrix of a graph. So I want you to notice at this point that there is a one-to-one correspondence between skew adjacency matrices of graphs and orientations. Because in a skew adjacency matrix, what you need to do for every edge, you need to make one of the entries aij or aji negative, and so which one you choose will determine an orientation of the corresponding edge. Now, given a skew adjacency matrix of a graph, we can look at the expansion of a Pfaffian and think about what it does for us. Well, first notice that we can assume that the summation is over perfect matchings of the graph. Because if the pairs I1, J1, I2, J2, etc. do not describe a perfect matching, do not correspond to a perfect matching of the graph, then the corresponding term in the Pfaffian is 0. Because one of these terms will be 0, and therefore the whole term will be 0. So when the matrix A is a skew adjacency matrix of a graph, I could replace this by summation over all perfect matchings of G. And what am I summing? Well, I'm summing plus and minus ones. Now, if by chance it happened that all these terms were plus one for every perfect matching, then the Pfaffian would actually give me exactly the number of perfect matchings of the graph. And that's the property I'm after. So what I want is that this is plus one for every perfect matching Chi. Now that, so for any given graph, that may or may not happen, depending, and it's also a function of the orientation I choose. So given a graph, I might or might not be able to find an orientation of the graph such that this holds. But if I find an orientation so that this holds, then that orientation is called a Pfaffian orientation of graph, of that graph. So D is Pfaffian if every term in the expansion of the Pfaffian of A is non-negative. And in that case, the Pfaffian of the matrix is equal to the number of perfect matchings. So that's great. So if I can make this happen, then I can evaluate the number of perfect matchings sufficiently. All it takes then is to calculate the determinant of the matrix, take the square root, and that will tell me the number of perfect matchings in the graph. So this is the object I want to study. And what I'd like to understand is, when is a graph Pfaffian? When does it have the property that there is an orientation which allows the efficient calculation of the number of perfect matchings? Now, from a graph theory point of view, this definition is not very useful. I did it this way to illustrate where the notion comes from. But luckily, there is a combinatorial description. So let me state it as a theorem. So D, an orientation of G, D the orientation of G, and then D is Pfaffian if and only if every central cycle is oddly oriented. So now I need to tell you what central means and what oddly oriented means. So let me define more generally a subgraph H of a graph G is central if, when you delete the vertex set of H from G, what you get has a perfect matching. And oddly oriented means the following. So this actually will only be of interest for even cycles. I'll come back to it in a minute. But let's say an even cycle is oddly oriented if it has an odd number of edges directed in either direction of the cycle. So an example, so here is an even cycle. Now you choose, you can traverse the cycle in one of two directions. So pick one direction, say this one. You traverse along the cycle and count how many edges are directed in that direction. So that condition, that number must be odd in order for the cycle to be oddly oriented. Now what happens if you choose the other direction? well, then the number of edges directed in that direction is also odd. So an example of an oddly oriented cycle would be this. Okay, so in any, if you walk this way, you find an odd number of edges directed that way, and therefore, since the cycle is even, it follows that if you walk in the other direction, you also find an odd number of edges in that direction. So I won't prove this theorem, it's not too hard, but at least let me tell you the reason why this is true. So what we want is that for every perfect matching, this evaluates to plus one. So it's enough to make sure that that's true for any two perfect matchings which are close to each other. Now, what does it mean for two perfect matchings to be close to each other? Well, when you take two perfect matchings, M1 and M2, the natural thing is to look at the symmetric difference, and the symmetric difference will be a disjoint union of cycles, and so the closest two matchings can come to each other is if the symmetric difference consists of exactly one cycle. So therefore, for this number to be plus one for every perfect matching, we need to make sure that if we have two perfect matchings such that the symmetric difference is a cycle, then both of them evaluate this expression to plus one. But if I have two matchings so that the symmetric difference is a cycle, that cycle is central, because the remains of both M1 and M2 form a perfect matching of the complement of that cycle. And in fact, that's equivalent. The cycle is central if and only if it can be expressed in this way. So what we need to investigate is, suppose I have a matching M1 for which this sum is plus 1, and I have another matching M2 which is close to M1 in the sense that the symmetric difference is a cycle. How do I make sure that M2 also has the property that it evaluates this 2 plus 1? Well, so that's some property of the symmetric difference of M1 and M2. And if you think about what it is, it's precisely the condition that I stated here, that the unique cycle in the symmetric difference is oddly oriented. So at this point, you can forget Pfaffians of matrices. We'll be only working with the combinatorial description. That every so we'll be using this theorem, and so the property of Pfaffian orientation that we'll be using is that every central cycle is oddly oriented. And once again, the reason for studying this concept is that if a graph has a Pfaffian orientation, then the number of perfect matchings can be calculated efficiently. So that's all very nice, but it would be useless if there weren't any interesting graphs that do have Pfaffian orientations. But luckily there are. So there is a classical theorem of Castellane. He was the man who invented Pfaffian orientations, which says that every planar graph is Pfaffian. So by saying is Pfaffian, I mean has a Pfaffian orientation. So that tells you that there is an interesting and fairly large class of graphs that do have Pfaffian orientations. And it was actually this theorem that allowed him to calculate the entropy of the planar grid. Here is an example of a graph which does not have a Pfaffian orientation, namely K33. The reason is as follows. Let me draw most of K33. So I haven't drawn one vertex. There's a vertex missing adjacent to B3. Now, suppose that we have a Pfaffian orientation of this, of the K33. And let's just look at what the orientation does on this K23. So we have three disjoint paths connecting these two vertices, say A and B. So for each of the paths, look at how many edges are directed from A to B. And look at the parity of that number. So for some two of these three paths, that parity will be the same. So let's say it's this and that. But then when you look at this cycle, that cycle is evenly oriented. Contradiction. That cycle is evenly oriented, and yet it's supposed to be oddly oriented because it's central. Its complement has a perfect matching, namely the one edge matching connecting this vertex to the vertex I haven't drawn. So that's an example of a graph which does not have a Pfaffian orientation. And so the question I want to study is, what graphs have Pfaffian orientations? So there is a classical theory of matching decomposition, which I want to briefly review. This is due to Kotzig, Lovas, and Plummer. This is a technique which allows us to reduce certain problems about matchings to graphs which possess more connectivity in a suitable sense, precisely for matching problems. So here's how it goes. First, I want to make an assumption now for the rest of my talk, and that is that the graphs I'll be talking about are what's called matching covered. So that is, every edge belongs to a perfect matching. I can make that assumption because it doesn't cost me anything. Edges which don't belong to a perfect matching can be thrown out without changing the problem. I'm talking about Pfaffian orientations. If an edge belongs to no perfect matching, I can orient it either way. It's not going to make any difference. So those might as well be thrown out to make our life easier. And now we can do a bit more. So there is a notion of a tight cut. So first, what I mean by a cut. So suppose you have a big graph and you pick a set of vertices. And I want to look at the set of edges, normally denoted by delta of x, the set of edges which have one end in x and the other end outside of x. That's what I mean by a cut. A cut is tight if it intersects every perfect matching in exactly one edge. So tight cuts will be of extreme importance in reducing our problems. Let me give you a couple of examples of tight cuts. One, a vertex star. Pick a vertex and all the edges incident with that vertex. That's a cut, and it's obviously a tight cut. Every perfect matching intersects it in exactly one edge. So that's trivial. That's not very interesting. I'll be interested in non-trivial tight cuts, which are all the remaining ones. So let me give you one more example of a tight cut, which is connected to Tutte's one-factor theorem. Suppose I have a set X, which has k vertices, and the complement of X has exactly k odd components. There may be some even components as well. I don't care about those. Okay, so delete a set of k vertices so that you get exactly k odd components. By an odd component, I mean a component with an odd number of vertices. Now notice, what is a perfect matching going to do? So this is an odd component, so no perfect matching can be confined just to that component, because there are an odd number of vertices. So every perfect matching has at least one edge sticking out of this component. Same for this, this, and that. So if you look at a perfect matching, for each of these components, there is an edge sticking out. Where do those edges go? Well, they go to these k vertices. This is exactly the same number as odd components. So what happens is, for every perfect matching, there is exactly one edge leaving each of these components and going to one of these k vertices that we deleted. So that in particular means that if I look at this cut, that's a tight cut. So that's an important example of a tight cut. Now, what's the use of tight cut? If there is a tight cut, so if a graph G has a non-trivial tight cut, say something like this, then I can do an obvious reduction. So first, shrink the right-hand side to a vertex. I'm going to graph G1, and then do the same to the left-hand side. I'm going to graph G2. And what happens is that many problems related to perfect matchings can be reduced this way. So I'm studying problem X, I find a tight cut, I look at these two graphs, G1 and G2. If I can solve problem X for G1 and G2, then I can combine the two solutions and get a solution for the graph X. So that in particular happens for FAFN orientations. So the original graph G has a FAFN orientation if and only if both G1 and G2 do, and the FAFN orientations of G1 and G2 can then be recombined to construct one in G. So that means that my original problem can be reduced to graphs which do not have any tight cuts. And that's very useful. This is like connectivity. You know, in what you want to do in graph structure theory is you want to increase the connectivity, because then graphs have a tendency to behave much better. And this is an exact analog of that. By the way, am I supposed to go on for 50 minutes, an hour, or what's the deal?
Yeah, yeah,
okay. Thank you. So now we want to know what are the graphs that don't have any tight cuts. And that has a nice answer. So let me first tell you two definitions. A brace bipartite graph such that every matching of size at most 2 extends to a perfect matching. This actually corresponds to connectivity, even though it may not look like it from the definition. But this, in fact, it corresponds exactly to strong two connectivity in digraphs by a very easy construction. A brick is a three-connected graph G such that G delete U delete V has a perfect matching for any two distinct vertices U and V. So I started out by assuming that the graph is matching covered, which is the same as saying that G delete U delete V has a perfect matching for every two adjacent vertices U and V. Now we're getting something stronger. We're getting the same conclusion for any two vertices, not necessarily adjacent. So the theorem, it's a deep result of Edmonds, Lavas, and Pulley-Blank, is that graphs with no tight cuts are these for those. So matching covered graph has no tight cut if and only if it is a brick or a brace. So bricks, braces are bipartite, bricks are not, and in fact are far from being bipartite. Because, you know, think a bipartite graph certainly cannot have this property. You know, think of a bipartite graph. First, it must have a perfect matching, so the two color classes have the same size. But then if you delete two vertices from the same color class, you're certainly not going to get a perfect matching. So this means that my original problem about Pfaffian graphs can be reduced to bricks and braces. For braces, we know a lot. So first, there was a theorem of Charles Little from 75, which says that for bipartite graphs, this graph, which does not have a Pfaffian orientation, is in fact the only obstruction. But careful, let's say precisely what it means to be an obstruction. So Charles Little proved that a bipartite graph is Pfaffian if and only if it has no matching minor isomorphic to K3-3. So the notion I need to explain is what I mean by a matching minor. This is the sense in which KC3 is the only obstruction. So let me remind you of the notion of a minor, which you're probably all familiar with. So in a minor of a graph or a matroid, there are two operations involved. We're allowed to take subgraphs, and we're allowed to contract edges. Likewise here, except we're restricted. So in a matching minor, we don't take subgraphs, we take central subgraphs. And we don't arbitrarily contract. Instead, what we do is what I called bicontraction. And bicontraction is the following. You're only allowed to contract edges incident with vertices of degree 2. So this vertex is meant to be of degree 2. And then what you have to do is you have to contract both of the incident edges. So the end result will look like this. Okay, so more precisely, one graph is a matching minor of another if you can go from the big graph to the small graph by taking central subgraphs and by contracting. So it's an analog of the usual minor of a graph, except it's much more restricted. You're restricting the subgraphs you can take, and you're restricting the amount of contraction you can do. The reason for these restrictions is that we want it to be true that if you have a big graph and a small graph which is a matching minor, and if the big graph has a Pfaffian orientation, we want the small graph to also have a Pfaffian orientation. And so if you look at the definition, the current working definition, we need to be able to say things about central cycles, but we won't be able to if we took arbitrary subgraphs. So I have a big graph G and a smaller subgraph H. And now from the fact that the big graph has a Pfaffian orientation, I want to deduce something about the smaller graph, which means I need to be able to say something about central subgraphs in H. But the only way I can hope to say something sensible about central subgraphs in H is if they're also central in G. And so the only way you can feasibly make it to work is if you insist that H itself is central in G. So that's why we only take central subgraphs, and by contraction, it's not too hard to show that doing by contraction the Pfaffian property is preserved. Plus, in Little's theorem, you want to stay within the class of bipartite graphs, whereas if you just did plain contraction, then you won't. So that cannot work. Yes. It has to be more restricted. So this is a beautiful theorem. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem to give a polynomial time algorithm to test whether a bipartite graph is Pfaffian, because it's not clear how to test whether a graph is a matching minor isomorphic to K3-3. So with Robertson and Seymour, and independently of us, McQuaig gave a structural description of bipartite Pfaffian graphs. So let me state it. So the theorem is actually about bipartite graphs, but I've already told you that the problem can be reduced to bricks and braces, so let me just state it for braces for simplicity. So a brace is fascin if and only if it is either is isomorphic to the Heawood graph, so that's just one exceptional graph on 14 vertices, or it can be obtained by foursomes from planar braces. So these, so this is really, I mean, I can restate it as a theorem for all bipartite graphs, but let me not do it for simplicity. This theorem characterizes bipartite Fafin graphs in terms of excluded minors. This one characterizes them in terms of structure. So this is a characterization from without. This is a characterization from within. The advantage of this one is that it actually does give a polynomial time test whether a bipartite graph is Fafin. The way the test works is roughly by checking whether a graph is a foursome of planar braces. There is a mild extension of this theorem which tells you precisely when a forecut gives you a valid decomposition into smaller pieces. So then the algorithm just searches for valid forecuts. If it finds a valid forecut, it breaks the graph into smaller pieces and then recurses on the smaller pieces. If there is no valid forecut, then it tests whether the graph is planar. If it's not, the answer is no. If it's yes, the answer is yes. Oh, I forgot to tell you what a foursome is. Foursome is the following. Given two graphs, pick a four cycle in each, pick an isomorphism between the four cycles, identify the corresponding vertices, and delete a subset of the resulting four cycle. So the edges, yes. Thank you. So in other words, Fafin braces are not much further away, are pretty much just the planar graphs. There's one exceptional graph on 14 vertices, and this foursome operation. This had some interesting implications for other problems. There was an old question of Poya whether you can calculate the permanent of a matrix by reducing it to calculating a determinant of a related matrix, which turns out to be equivalent to this. This is equivalent to the even directed cycle problem. So the question is, given a directed graph, does it have an even directed cycle? Again, it's equivalent to the question of whether a bipartite graph is a Pfaffian orientation. And it's also equivalent to a problem of interest in economics, namely the following. You're given a matrix, a square matrix A, and actually I don't care about the entries, all I care about is the signs. And by a sign I mean plus, minus, or zero. And that matrix is called sign non-singular if, however, you fill in the entries with numbers, subject to keeping the signs what they're supposed to be, what you get is a non-singular matrix. So the decision problem, you're given a square matrix, and you're asked, is that matrix sign non-singular, is equivalent to deciding whether a bipartite graph has a Pfaffian orientation. So it's solved by this theorem. This is of interest to economists because what they want is they want to solve system of equations, except they don't know the coefficients. They only know relationships of the form, like if demand goes up, then price goes up. So they know the derivatives, but they don't know the actual values. So they have the system of equations where they only know the sign patterns, but not the actual numbers. And they want to know, do the sign patterns of the data imply a sign pattern of the solution? And that's equivalent to this sign non-singularity. Okay, so that's the story about the Pfaffian property for bipartite graphs. Now on to general graphs. So by the theorem of Edmonds, Levasse, and Pulleybank, it suffices to understand braces. So the question is, when is a brace Pfaffian? Is it brace Pfaffian? Thank you. So my student Sergey Norin proved a beautiful theorem, which is actually about general graphs, not necessarily bricks. So let me state that theorem. A graph, an arbitrary graph, is Pfaffian if and only if it can be drawn in the plane possibly with crossings, such that every perfect matching intersects itself an even number of times. Let me recall Castellane's theorem from the beginning of the talk, which says that every planar graph has a Pfaffian orientation. So this is a generalization. If a graph is planar, then it obviously satisfies this condition, because it can be drawn so that every perfect matching intersects itself zero times. But this actually gives an if and only if characterization. So it's a very pretty theorem. There aren't many results along the similar lines. The only result that's close to this that I'm aware of is theorem of Hanani and Tat, which is also interesting, so let me mention it. So the theorem of Hanani and Tat is about graphs that you can draw in the plane with crossings, but such that every two edges intersect an even number of times. So, you understand, I mean, with crossings, such that every two edges intersect even number of times, then what? Well, it turns out that then the graph is planar. And it actually can be redrawn so that any two edges intersect zero times. So this is the closest known theorem to Sergei's result. I don't know of any other theorem which talks about the intersections of perfect matchings. So this is very pretty, but it's not very useful in terms of deciding or being able to decide whether a graph is Pfaffian. Because how do you test for this property? Nevertheless, it was useful to us in terms of generating some frightening examples. So I felt for a long time that there should be a theorem for bricks along the similar lines as this theorem for braces. That there should be a theorem which says a brick is Pfaffian if and only if it either can be drawn in the plane or the projective plane or the Klein bottle in a certain way, or possibly a combination of these. But that turned out to be completely wrong. So Sergei constructed these examples of graphs where you take a complete graph and add n minus 2 vertices to them, and then connect them like this. Well, let's not worry about the details for now, but basically what he did, he constructed a brick containing Kn, well, and worse yet, a Pfaffian brick containing Kn for any n. And that completely killed my conjecture. I was hoping that Pfaffian bricks would go on low genus surfaces or could be combined from them by some sums on low order cut sets. But this shows that that's completely wrong, because you can have bricks containing K 1 million and, you know, for any value of million. So you cannot hope to be able to draw Pfaffian bricks on surfaces of fixed genus. However, there seems to be some hope. Let me spend the last couple of minutes telling you what that hope might be. So we recently invented a notion which we called matching width. Which is an analog of the better known tree width of graphs. So you may be familiar with that notion. I don't have time to go into the details of that, but let me just say that tree width is a useful parameter both in theory and in the design of algorithms. One useful fact is that graphs of bounded tree width or many problems can be solved efficiently when restricted to graphs of bounded treelets. And by many problems, I mean really a huge number. All the usual suspects you can think of, like chromatic number, independence number, clique number, and so on, and can all be calculated efficiently when restricted to graphs of bounded treelets. So we came up with something related, which we gave the working definition matching with. And what we were able to show is that for graphs of low matching width, we can decide whether they're Pfaffian in polynomial time. So that's a useful fact. So Pfaffianness can be tested for graphs of bounded matching width. The second relevant piece of information is that this family and all the other frightening examples that we know of have low matching width. So it's plausible, and that's currently the best hope for a structure theorem, that the following might be true. That a Pfaffian Pfaffian brick of high matching width let's say matching with at least 100. It may very well be true with matching with at least 4, but I'm going to give myself some slack. Has a matching decomposition into three classes: planar graphs. Those got to be listed by Castellane's theorem. They're there and they're Pfaffian. Projective planar graphs. With at most 2 odd faces. And third, Klein-Bottle graphs. With all faces even. So that's currently our best hope. So my initial conjecture was that would be true without this additional assumption. That turned out to be completely false because of those examples up there. But now it seems that maybe if we that all the nasty examples have low matching width, and so if we just up the matching width a little bit, then my original conjecture will still be true. Now this, so this won't be as nice as what I had hoped initially, but since that was false, this is our best hope, and it still will answer the question of testing for the Pfaffian property, because if matching width is low, then we can test whether the graph is Pfaffian by an analog of the bounded treelet algorithms methods. And if it's decently big, then we would have a structure theorem. If only we could prove it, of course. So what's our evidence for this, other than lack of counterexamples? Well, there's one piece of evidence, and that's the following. We were able to show that if we have a graph, so let me draw a graph here. It's drawn in the Klein bottle, the usual representation of the Klein bottle. So this is a kind of a 4x4 Klein bottle grid. So we were able to show that if a graph contains this graph as a matching minor. Now by that I mean abstractly, not as a surface minor or anything. Just if it has this graph as a matching minor and our graph is Fatin, then our graph actually must be drawn on the Klein bottle with all faces even to satisfy this third conclusion. But of course there's still a long way to go from the beginning to that conclusion. Thank you very much for your attention.